Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure Policy Committee to order for March 1st, 2023. Quorum is present, and happy birthday, Representative Franzen.
There's bagels for members.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. First item on the agenda today is approval of our minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 15th, 2023? Representative Smith?
I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Smith moves to approve the minutes for February 15th, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. Minutes are approved. So we have quite a few bills on the agenda for today, which is we're not used to that in this committee, so hopefully we'll move quickly and get all our questions answered. So first bill on our agenda is House File 2036, and Representative Carroll, is he, there he is right there. So I will move to re-refer House File 2036 to the State Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. So Representative Carroll, welcome to the committee, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair, and welcome members and also Lead Franzen. I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be carrying this bill. It's on behalf of the administration. I have testifier Wayne Kozlowski. Did I do that right?
You did.
All right,
you.
Great. So HF 2036 is administration's bill to clarify and enhance the state building sustainability statutes. It is an effort to improve compliance with the sustainable building 2030 requirements and make state operations more cost effective. To do this, the bill provides greater clarity for contractors by streamlining sustainable building and energy use statutes. The bill also encourages renewable energy installation on state facilities by increasing the cap of renewable energy that can be generated on state buildings. The energy would only be used for the designated facility and would not be sold back to the electric energy grid. The bill will give agencies and local bonding projects more options to meet sustainable building 2030 standards. Constructing and remodeling buildings that are more efficient reduces energy costs and allows agencies to focus their appropriations on their core missions.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Assistant Commissioner Wazlowski. Yeah. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for hearing our policy bill. For the record, my name is Wayne Wazlowski, and I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Administration. And I'll just walk through the sections of the bill. Representative Carroll provided a great overview of the intent with the bill. So sections 1, 2, and 4 of the bill address renewable energy systems on major renovation and new construction projects with state funding. Over time, a variety of statutes have been enacted requiring consideration of renewable energy systems on new construction and major remodeling projects. The proposed changes would streamline the requirements around renewable energy systems that design firms need to meet when preparing pre-designs for projects. They would make the definition of renewable energy systems consistent with existing statutes, and they would remove the requirement for locating solar and wind turbines directly on the building site. They would also remove a cap that exists on the amount of solar that can be constructed. These changes would facilitate more comprehensive consideration of current renewable energy technology on construction projects and help facilitate selection of the most cost-effective solution for achieving sustainable 2030 energy standards as required by law. Section 3 of the bill extends the term for a revolving loan program from 7 to 10 years. The revolving loan program provides zero interest loans to state agencies to pay for building improvements that reduce energy and water consumption in state-owned facilities. The extended payment would allow for more energy efficiency work to be completed at state facilities. And with that, Madam Chair, members, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you. I've got too many papers here now. Are there any members of the public that would that wish to testify on House File 2036 before we move on to member discussions? Seeing none, then. Members, any discussion to House File 2036? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, Mr. Commissioner. Could you define for us what cost-effective renewable energy entails? Is there a payback, a return on investment, or exactly what is cost-effective renewable energy?
Mr. Wazlowski?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. There's a couple of ways of looking at. One is focused on the useful life of the system that's being installed. Typically, when we think of our state-owned facilities, we're going to own those facilities for through the whole life of the building. So you're thinking from a building standpoint in terms of a 50, 60, 70-year time frame. When we're getting down to this renewable energy systems, you're looking at the useful life. So, for example, some solar installations have a 20 to 25-year useful life, and you're obviously looking to have that payback happen earlier than that, the end of that useful life, so that you have that period of time where you're having achieving those significant savings. The one thing I would note is those payback schedules as utility rates have increased and the cost of renewable energy systems has come down, those payback schedules have gotten a lot more attractive over time.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just wondering, do any of the state buildings currently meet the standards that are in House File 2036? And then what types of energy and renewable energy and efficiencies do you plan on installing in our state buildings?
Mr. Wazlowski?
Madam Chair, Representative, so under existing law for new projects, for new construction and major renovation, there's sustainable 2030 requirements are required, and that's a progressive, that's in state laws, and that's a progressive increase. So right now it's 80% more efficient than a building that was constructed in 2003. So that's the standard that's in state law to be met. And existing projects are required to that receive funding. So new construction, major renovation are required to meet that standard. So what happens though, that incremental increases every 5 years, so it gets more and more challenging to meet that standard just by having efficiency in the building. So that's where you have to incorporate renewable energy systems uh-huh. into projects to meet the standard.
Representative Franzen, any follow-up?
So what types of energy efficiency and renewable standards do you plan on?
Madam Chair, Representative, most common has been solar, but certainly there's, and that's part of the right. intent of the bill is to, obviously technology is changing fast, and so you it really is to provide a full range of options for meeting the standard. So there is nothing specific. You would evaluate that on a project by project basis and then make a decision on what's the best option for
Representative Franzen, one more follow-up.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me. So my next question then deals with what's been in the news and what's floating around is the new state office building. So has there been any discussion what that looks like? Are we talking, wind turbines in the yard, solar panels on the roofs? Could you explain? Because I've been getting asked sure. this myself.
Yeah. Mr. Wazlowski?
Madam Chair, Representative, one thing we're fortunate on the Capitol campus is we're part of the district energy system of St. Paul District Energy, and they're one of the leading entities, have been for a long time, on use of renewable energy to feed the district energy system. So that both from a heating and cooling standpoint, that would be the baseline. And that's on the campus for all of our state systems. For the Senate building, for example, to meet the sustainable 2030, we also added solar on the roof top. And so solar is certainly a potential. Geothermals also a possibility. There wouldn't be wind turbines that wouldn't be part of the equation.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing that we have is obviously a strong partnership with Xcel Energy and their energy design assistance program, and there's some opportunities there with through our purchasing, how we purchase energy or electricity. We've been doing working with them to source that renewably as well.
Any other member questions?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Carroll. Can you explain to us the repealers? I believe there's two repealers in the bill, and why those are important, and how that will change things for state-funded buildings, specifically the repealers in the language.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that question. Representative, I will turn it over to our testifier.
Mr. Wozlowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So the repealers, this is the key part, is so over time, the legislature has enacted various laws on trying to incorporate renewable energy systems into projects, and really what's happened is those statutes have become outdated as far as the current technology and the options that are out there for renewable energy. So it essentially would eliminate the existing statutes and really provide in other statutes and under 216B, there's different definitions for renewable energy, so it broadened the options available for renewable energy, the types of systems and sources that could be used. It would also remove the cap that's in place on solar installations. There was a 300 kilowatt cap per project, and it removes that cap and really gets back to, you want to do, we're not going to sell energy back on the grid, but try to match the energy demand for the building with the amount of renewable energy that's being installed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. Would this result then in, ultimately it should result in more solar across state buildings, is that correct?
Mr. Wozlowski?
Madam Chair, Representative, certainly would do that, but also other types of renewable, whether that's biomass or hydrogen down the road, wind energy for an appropriate facility. It really opens up the full range of options to be considered on a project by project basis.
Thank you.
Any other member questions? Seeing no further discussion to the bill, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2036 to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way. Thank you very much. I had a really hard time not thinking about Monsters, Inc. the whole time. next up on the agenda is House File 1364, Representative Kraft. Oh, I'm sorry, 1346. Representative Kraft, would you like to move your bill to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, I would like to move House File 1346 to Transportation, Finance, and Policy.
Thank you. And Representative Kraft, looks like you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it, please?
Yes, I would like to move the amendment A1, and it's to get at the bill in the situation that I'd like to be heard. And it really does two things. One, it adds a prevailing wage, which is likely required in this anyway because it's federal money, but to just clarify that we want our workers paid fairly. And then secondly, a training program for folks that would be installing these that in the proposed rulemaking seemed like it was going to be required, and in fact in the actual rulemaking that just came out yesterday is required. So just putting those two things in there.
Thank you. So any member discussion to the A1? All right. Seeing all those in favor, or excuse me, Representative Kraft renews his motion to adopt the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So Representative Kraft, go ahead and please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In late 2021, President Biden signed the IIJA, or Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, into law. Part of that law created the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program, or NEVI, which provides funds for states to install fast chargers for electric vehicles. It aims to provide reliable, long-distance EV travel. Minnesota expects to invest about $68 million of federal dollars from the program over 5 years. There's a 20% non-federal match required, or about $17 million, bringing the total EV infrastructure investment to about $85 million. NEVI funds will be used to build out federally designated alternative fuel corridors. For Minnesota, the two initial corridors are I-94 and I-35. Stations must be no more than 50 miles apart and within 1 mile of the corridor. After these corridors are completed, additional corridors will be added. This is a simple bill that authorizes the program so we can unlock these important federal dollars, spend both federal and other non-state funds to install EV chargers, and clarifies, excuse me, that EV charging stations can be at both public and private locations. With that, I do have a testifier, Amber Dahlman from MnDOT, to come to give the committee more detail about the plan, and then we'd be happy to answer questions.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Dahlman. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Amber Dahlman. I am with MnDOT's Office of Sustainability and Public Health. And as Representative Kraft, I think, outlined and simply stated that that what we're primarily looking to do is authorize the electric vehicle infrastructure program and be able to use these funds off of trunk highway right-of-way in order that we're able to enter into agreements with private partners and simplify that process.
Thank you. We also have one more testifier on the list. If you'd like to come up to the podium here. Adam Hansen from Associated Builders and Contractors. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cagle and members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors, Minnesota North Dakota chapter. ABC's 330 commercial and industrial contractor members are part of the 73% of the construction workforce in Minnesota who choose not to join a union. I want to thank Representative Kraft for meeting with us on this bill and on the amendment yesterday. Sounds like there may be some discussions on how we can work together to clarify some language on that. But our electrical contractor members are from all four corners of our state. They build a lot of our clean energy infrastructure already, from commercial wind and solar projects on residential rooftops, commercial, as well as infrastructure for EV charging stations, both on the residential and commercial side already. So we want to be able to keep our members working in this, and unfortunately the amendment we have before us might limit who can and who cannot work on these projects under the bill. Our members, licensed electricians, undergo the 8,000 required supervised work hours and have successfully passed the DLI's licensing exam. In addition, they're current with their continuing education requirements as well. Unfortunately, the requirement under the bill as amended now for the EVITP training program is something that we think will slow down the implementation and the build out of these solar these charging stations, sorry, and it also, like I said, limit who can and who cannot work on these projects. DLI's licensing data shows that there are 2,500 licensed electrical contractors in Minnesota in all four corners of the state, and they employ over 11,000 licensed journey worker electricians, all of them including in your district. EVITP's website unfortunately shows that there are only 40 contractors in Minnesota who have successfully completed this training program. This means that only 1% of Minnesota's electrical contractors are going to be allowed to build these EV charging stations. And not surprisingly to ABC and our members, the only contractors listed among those 40 are IBEW signatory contractors. The amendments, the bill as amended, requirement favors one proprietary training program over others that are quickly emerging in the marketplace, and we support an all of the above training and certification program in addition to our state's strict and rigorous licensing requirement for electricians. I use the term proprietary because the EVITP's own website and their frequently asked questions document talks about the proprietary nature of their training program. And it's been said over the past year and a half, including by IBEW leadership, both here in Minnesota and nationally, that this is their program, that they helped develop it. It's theirs. They testified in previous House committees that it was their program. So that's why we have concerns as merit shop contractors. According to the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, requiring one specific type of certification will likely adversely impact the disadvantaged businesses, which are more likely to struggle to access training facilities and other institutions. In addition, the amendment as written doesn't appear to even allow apprentices or registered unlicensed individuals to build these charging stations, which will only further limit who is allowed to and who cannot work on these projects. It's been suggested and said that the amendment for the EVITP is required to satisfy the federal rules which were published yesterday. But what is also in those federal rules published yesterday is the option for contractors who have a state registered apprenticeship program to also build out these infrastructure projects. We would support as many options and avenues to build these as possible, not just one narrow training program. Our electrical contractor members and the men and women that they employ are some of the best in the industry, and it's getting noticed. In fact, a lot of our electrical contractor members and their employees themselves are routinely solicited, not just at job sites or at their office, but including at their homes by IBEW recruiters. So that should tell members of the committee and the public the type of good work that they're doing around Minnesota. Like I said, ABC supports in all of the above an inclusive contracting approach when we're talking about taxpayer-funded construction projects. Happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you very much. And Representative Gilman, was your question to the testifier? Okay. All right, then. Perhaps we will want the testifiers just...
Madam Chair,
oh.
We have two.
Oh, okay. To the testifier, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, of the 40, you said licensed contractors of IBEW unions, how many of those are in outstate Minnesota?
So,
Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. Just on quick looking at the map, if you go to the EVITP's website, most of them are heavily concentrated in the Twin Cities surrounding metro area. I mean, I looked at your district, for example, and where you're from in Starbuck, there are four licensed contractors in at least where you live. None of them are in the EVITP program. The closest one to where you live would be either North Mankato or St. Cloud. The entire western part of Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, there's not a single one certified under the program.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, this is very concerning. I'd like to understand the reason for the amendment when we get that far, but to pretty much single out and exclude the contractors from greater Minnesota to me is not the way that this committee talked about going throughout the year.
Correct. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Hansen, thank you for that. You know, doing some a little quick search here, Alexandria has 20 electrical contractors, which none of them are in, would qualify under the program in the amendment. Representative Anderson, you have four electrical contractors, which none of them are in, would qualify. Dassel, mm-hmm. You have four electrical contractors, would not qualify. Representative Igo, you have 15 electrical contractors, including the Wabana, is it Wabana Electric? None of them would qualify as well. However, members, congratulations to Representative Kraft. I think you have six of them in your district. So my question then to you would be, why is an electrical license not enough? What is so special about this program, or is it purposely meant to fence out those that choose not to belong in the union?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Franzen, for the bagels, which I'll have one, and for your detailed work on this. A few comments. One is, as I mentioned, the final rulemaking on this came out yesterday, and the point about the apprenticeship programs, that's in the final rulemaking. I think that's something we should put in the bill, and I would intend to make a modification for going forward. I think that's reasonable. Now, on the comment that this is a proprietary program, I didn't come into this knowing about this program. However, I will read to you some things from the rulemaking itself, okay? And that is, and this is what is required to participate in this program. The final rule establishes a requirement that the workforce installing, maintaining, and operating the chargers has appropriate licenses, certifications, and training. This final rule also requires that all electricians installing, operating, or maintaining EV supply equipment have a certification from the Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Training Program, EVITP, or graduation or a continuing education certificate from a registered apprenticeship program. Other comments, later on in this rulemaking, the EVITP is the only EV charging specific brand neutral training program that exists today and is utilized by both large and small contractors. The DOT, DOE, and Department of Labor will work with state, local, and industry partners to continue to expand the pool of talent for EVITP certified electricians, as the online certification can be completed in 20 hours. Costs for certification requirements are an eligible use of funds under the NEVI program. Additionally, the EVITP was created through a collaboration of automakers, EVSE manufacturers, educational institutions, utility partners, electric industry professionals, and other key stakeholders in the EV charging market to provide qualified electricians with the most comprehensive training available in the market today. After considering the comments, that's the key portions. So I've learned about this program. It's clearly something that's required to participate in this. It seems like it's been done by not a proprietary group, but quite a collaboration from folks here, and so we're just aligning our approach to match that.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. One more follow-up, Mr. Hansen, is this question to Mr. Hansen, or can we let him go?
Yeah, maybe we can let Mr.
Ms. Dahlman, maybe if you'd like to come up to answer any questions. Go ahead. Yep,
okay,
Representative
Franson. All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, so on just kind of average here, how long does it take to build out a station? And then just to follow up on there, on this training program, how long is it for a certification? Do you have those numbers? Let's say there is no wiggle room, right? And then what's the estimated cost of such a program? And can non-union members join or, apply for this certification?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Franzen. I can answer some of those, and then I'm going to ask my testifier also. So, and I may need you to refresh my memory because there were several questions in there. The amount of time it takes to get the certification, from what I read, it appears 20 hours can be done online. You asked, the other questions you asked were how long, go ahead.
The cost.
I'm not sure of the cost. Is it open to anyone, union members or not? Appears to be open to anyone, so.
And then one
time. Representative Franzen.
And then how long is a build out of a charging station?
That's where I need to.
Okay.
Thank
Ms.
you,
Dahlman.
Madam Chair. And that's where I need to phone a friend.
Ms. Dahlman.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, thank you for the questions. Regarding the build-out of the stations, as Representative Kraft mentioned, our first two alternative fuel corridors are I-94 and I-35, and we anticipate the build-out of those by summer of 2024. So we have over a year for those stations to be built out in that first phase. There are remaining phases where we'll identify where future charging stations will be sited. The other thing that I may add regarding workforce development is that a part of the NEVI program does include workforce development, and a portion of those funds are to be used towards developing and training future workforce to work on electric vehicle charging stations.
Thank you. Sorry for skipping over you, Representative Gilman. Go ahead.
It's her birthday. She's the queen. All right. Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. So, Ms. Dahlman, I did meet with MnDOT this past week when we had snow days, and I was very intrigued by what's happening here. Have you located, on 94 and 35, all the locations that you wish to go to already? And, what I kept hearing over and over was, MnDOT isn't in the business of, it's getting the locations figured out, and it's going to be very competitive because it will bring in a lot of business for wherever it is. And then My second part question is there any, you know, concerns counties and cities also have is with this being in out of the right of way on private property, will there be tax incentives for businesses, or will cities not, you know, be able to get all their taxes based on, you know, these EV stations being there? Like, will there, do you know what I mean? I'm trying to phrase because we were talking about this with the county. There won't be tax exemptions. Will there be on a certain part of property that is private? So the city and the county would be out of, you know, taxable.
Ms. Dahlman or Representative Kraft?
Want to start?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, thank you for the questions. First, regarding the locations of the charging stations, as Representative Kraft mentioned, along 35 and 94, the charging stations are to be located no more than 50 miles apart. And so we have thus far in our NEVI plan identified clusters of where charging stations could be sited as for potential future charging stations. And we are in the process of identifying how we would establish criteria to select sites, and we'll be engaging a range of stakeholders on how to best prioritize criteria in that selection process. We do understand that there may be some competition in certain areas in particular, and I would like to keep that in mind as we're developing the criteria. Regarding your second question, whether or not there will be tax exemptions, I am not able to answer that question right now and can certainly look into it more and get back.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I don't have an answer either, but good question, and we'll dig into it and have an answer before next committee.
All right, thank you, Representative Igo. And then we have Representative Anderson, and then I'd like to see if we can move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question kind of comes in how we're going to build these out. You know, obviously, MnDOT cannot charge for the electricity due to federal and state laws, so we're going to need to partner with entities. But my question kind of goes deeper into that. You know, when we read into if we're going to set up charging stations, there's going to have to be lots of upgrades to the grid, and we're going to have to work with our power producers to do that. Are we going to be able to couple those federal funds to do that? Because if we're not going to be able to, and we're going to have to put that back on our producers, that's going to go right back to the ratepayers, a.k.a. the taxpayer. So that's my question.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Igo. Do you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, that is a good question. I don't have an answer for you at this point.
And I think that's kind of our goal here, right, is to make it as seamless and as coordinated as possible. And so I think that, you know, that is really the main goal of this committee and how we're going to, I'm hoping that next week's committee hearing will really start to kind of hash out how that's going to happen.
Okay.
Representative Igo.
If I may, Madam Chair. Yeah. So, you know, the reason I looked it up, because I've been looking into like what it can cost, especially, and we have supply chain shortages when it comes to upgrading transformers and stuff for sites like this, the cost for just doing four fast chargers to the grid, and especially when we look at the MISO grid and we're hurting as it is, it can cost upwards of $150,000 for four chargers. So if we're going to do this huge build out, I mean, we need to be factoring this into the cost, because otherwise it's going to go right back to our taxpayers and our ratepayers. It's a huge problem we need to address.
Thank you, Representative Igo. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, kind of along the same lines as Representative Igo. These will be level three chargers, I assume, correct? And will that require the installation of three-phase power, which is extremely expensive?
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for the question. You're correct. They will be fast chargers. I am unaware of and can get you an answer regarding the electricity.
And this will be going to transportation as well. So, and Representative Kraft, serves on that committee too, so we can get some of those and I serve on that committee too, so we can get some of those questions answered. So. Representative Smith, quickly, and then we will move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just be really quick. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this before. Since we have so many people in the room that are going to be in charge of this, I know many of the first phase, as we talked about before, is outlined in our federal bill that allows us these funds. just another recommendation that the second largest metropolitan area, Rochester, in Minnesota, does not have any of these that are currently going to be built between here and the first major metropolitan area, the Twin Cities. Would love that to be something that the Transportation Committee takes up. I just felt it was necessary to throw that in there. But thank you very much. Happy to support this bill.
And Representative Kraft, sorry.
Yeah, so Madam Chair and Representative Smith, so thanks for the point on that. This is the first phase, this is the first year, and so there's expected to be several other years, and there are other alternative fuel corridors, and I believe some of them do go through Rochester as well.
All right, we have Representative Ream and then Representative Franson, and then we really do have to move on, so I'm giving us like two more minutes, and then we're moving on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question about the charging stations. I know there's been talk about Tesla charging stations versus other charging stations. The ones that we're building, will they be, will a Tesla user as well as another type of EV owner be able to charge their vehicles along this corridor? And could you clarify how that would work?
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative Rim, thank you for the question. The NEVI-funded charging stations are required to use an industry-standard charging port called the Combined Charging System, and it is compatible with most electric vehicles. Tesla drivers would need to have a CCS adapter to use these funded stations.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. All right, Representative Franson, real quick.
To Mr. Kraft, Representative Kraft, sorry. Could you guarantee to the body that the registered, anybody registered in our districts would be able to participate in this? And then also, is Excel here that they can answer those questions? I just am very concerned that we're going to pass off this bill without having these important questions answered on the
we actually really do have we have two more bills on, and there are plenty more stops for this, and I know that it's going to be referred to Representative Hornstein's committee, so I understand he's hearing these questions too, so we can definitely make sure that we get those answered before its next committee stop. I know that you don't serve on that committee, but we do, and Representative Kraft does, so I think that we'll make sure to take those questions with us.
But with all due respect, Madam Chair, that doesn't lead me with a lot of confidence here. I'm sure it would only take Excel 30 seconds to answer.
Would you please come down to the... And then we will be voting on this bill after Excel comes down. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Representative, while they're coming down, on the guaranteeing.
Yeah, you can't guarantee.
I can't guarantee the federal, but I can, from what I've read, that is seems to be the intention, and I'll, you know, ask some questions. That would certainly be the intention.
And it was my intention. Also, this committee was supposed to be held last Wednesday, where we were having the whole hour to discuss this bill. And so what I can do is that after deadline, we could come back and have the full committee that we promised for last Wednesday, if that works for you guys, because I do think, you know, we had a whole presentation with Excel and MnDOT and really talking about this in depth. So I think that would be very useful. If that works, yeah. Representative Franson. Okay, good. Then can we vote on this bill and move forward? Yeah. Awesome. All right. Do you want to go ahead and address the committee? Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Jim Pearson with Excel Energy. I must admit I was in the back row sipping my coffee, so I think I missed the question. So if Representative Franson could just remind me of the question.
Representative Franson. Okay, Representative Weigel.
Yeah, thank you for coming down. We were just going to be asking how much it would be for, like, Excel, for instance, to have to upgrade the grid around these chargers and what it would cost, and if you would be able to be covered under this bill through these federal dollars, or you'd have to pass it on to your ratepayers.
Mr. Pearson.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Igo and Representative Franson, great question. The answer in terms of cost does vary a lot site by site. Representative Anderson asked about three-phase power. When you're meeting the requirements of the NEVI, which is 150 kW chargers, absolutely you need three-phase power to be able to do that. So depending on where that power is, how far we need to go to get that power to the pedestal where the charger will be set, those prices can range quite a bit. So just in, again, round numbers, and there's lots of variables here, but it can be anywhere from, you know, a couple $100,000 up. And so we need to be mindful of that, and that's part of the conversation we have with site hosts. I would need to double check with our folks. In fact, our person who was scheduled last week would know this. But it is my understanding that the NEVI dollars can be used for some what we call the make ready infrastructure or the supply infrastructure. So I think that does help diffuse this. But a more holistic conversation about that when there's more time, we'd love to be part of that, and we can follow up with the committee to get into that a little bit more in detail when there's more time.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to that committee because there's lots of questions. So, all right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Kraft renews his motion to re-refer House File 1346 as amended to the Transportation Finance Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You are on your way to transportation. Next up, Representative Ryer, 749. I will move to re-refer House File 749 to the State Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Members, there's a copy of the presentation that goes along with this bill in your packet. Representative Ryer, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. It's a pleasure to be here today. House File 749 provides an update to Minnesota's sustainable building guidelines to include climate change resilience guidelines. These updates are offered as part of the process outlined in statute to periodically review and update the guidelines. You'll hear more from our testifiers about the rationale for and direction of this current round of updates. However, I'd like to set the stage by highlighting the need. We're seeing increases in extreme weather events, flooding, and wildfires. Minnesota is warmer and wetter than ever, and the risks to our built infrastructure are rising accordingly. We have the opportunity to move forward responsibly by putting guidelines in place that anticipate and address these risks. As you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued an evaluation report about the Sustainable Building Guidelines in February. And while many improvement opportunities were identified and will warrant further attention, the update process embodied in this bill was not a focus of their recommendations. However, as we move this bill forward, there may be some additional changes incorporated. Now I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers to speak more about the needs addressed by these modifications. Thank you, Chair Cagle and members. I'll look forward to your questions and appreciate your support.
All right, I'll call up Professor Richard Graves, Director and Associate Professor at University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Graves. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota, and I believe my slides are included in your packet for information. In the interest of time, I'll just hit a few key points. It has come up in previous legislative sessions to add resilience to the sustainability guidelines, and because of that, in 2018, we did a study funded by MPCA to look at if we took buildings that were designed to the sustainability guidelines and exposed them to disruptions or things that would have those buildings be more resilient, what would the things be that would need to be added to the guidelines to add resilience into the B3 program? And maybe I'll step back for a second. So, you know, sustainability is in statute right now for the B3 guidelines. What resilience would do would be to add the ability for state buildings to respond, absorb, adapt to, and recover from disruptive events. And those could be a variety of things, climate change, natural disasters, or other things. In the 2018 report, we found that a number of the current guidelines that were created for sustainability do have resilience benefits, the energy efficiency benefits, some of the requirements for solar and other things do have resilience benefits. In addition, as part of that report, we created a resilience planning tool that state-funded projects could use that they put in their location anywhere in the state, and it works at the county level to identify risks and things that projects should consider to be part of their capital project. So the challenge and the thing that this bill fixes is out of that report, we could only bring into the B3 guidelines things that were sustainability plus resilience requirements, anything that is resilience alone, and we can't point towards sustainability benefits, we couldn't include in the guidelines for capital construction. So slide 11 points to examples of things that would be resilience-only guidelines that this bill would allow us the ability to add. And those things would be in the energy design, downscaling global climate data to have forward predicted data that's better, a better source of information around planning projects. That's both on the energy side and the site design side. Fortunately, many of the site guidelines that would benefit resilience are already in the site and water guidelines because they do have sustainability benefits as well. There would, in addition, be some additional guidelines that look at indoor environmental quality, increasing the insulation value of exterior envelopes to allow for passive survivability of projects. If the power is out for an extended amount of time, the envelope would hold heat or cooling in the building. And then the last section, it would add the ability to do some things around material and waste, which would be things like considering the fortified standards, which is a national level set of standards that's designing to increase resilience for building envelopes and roofs for severe weather. And then we could also look at products for impact resistant and other standards, and then looking at some other requirements that might, for instance, termite resistance and other things that hasn't been a problem in Minnesota but is increasingly emerging as an issue that maybe some buildings need to consider in Minnesota. So with that, I can close and answer any questions.
Thank you. We also have another testifier, Aurora Vatran. Did I get that right? Probably not. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Aurora Vatran, and I am the legislative and political director for the Minnesota 100% campaign. We are a cross-sector, statewide, multiracial, intersectional campaign to build an equitable, clean energy future for everyone in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Cagle, members of the committee and staff for the opportunity to testify today. And thank you, Representative Ryer, for your leadership on this bill that would add climate change resilience to our state sustainable building guidelines. Our campaign supports House File 749 because for the buildings Minnesota invests in to be truly sustainable, they ought to be both climate adapted and climate resilient. Our state has taken historic action to address climate change, and we're doing the work to prevent the most detrimental impacts we would face if we don't change course. But we know that the people of Minnesota are already experiencing the impacts of climate change and that they will get worse as the effects of our actions to address the crisis catch up to the impacts already set in motion by generations of emissions. Minnesota's future will see increasing windstorms, extreme heat, and larger, more sudden precipitation events. And these impacts affect our built infrastructure in concrete ways that need to be considered as we're building the infrastructure that we'll be relying on to keep us safe and sheltered when these extreme weather events happen. Representative Ryer's bill will ensure that our buildings are designed to help Minnesotans thrive in the future we face and prevent wasted state financial resources. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify in 749? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Why do I do that? Why do I do that?
You manifest it, I will make it.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair. My coffee is so hot, I have not had enough. And so by the time, I'm not a morning person. This is what happens. Just for the record, Madam Chair, I have been told numerous times that this is not the climate change committee, but yet again today, we hear again more climate change, climate change, climate change. And when I talk then, because then it opens the door for me to start talking about climate change, and then, Madam Chair, you come in and rebut me and say this is not the climate change committee, that would be the Climate Change Committee that is, who's the chair of that committee these days? Can't keep up. But anyway, so just putting that on the record, because it's disappointing when you come into the sustainable infrastructure. Now, granted, this bill has climate change in your deal, but when we hear from a very partisan organization called 100%, very partisan, they're all about climate change. I mean, the world you just heard is going to end. I thought it was going to end. I thought it was going to die in the 80s with acid rain. Honestly, it was a terrifying time. We watched all kinds of propaganda videos. But okay, anyway, I'm just putting that on the record. We're not going to die. Climate change is not going to kill us. But this bill here that we have, I am just wondering, does it add cost to the state building construction and then or renovation costs to local units of government in your bill? So does it raise costs for state taxpayers for the state office buildings, any office buildings, and then renovation costs for the local units of government? And then on top of that, we just heard from the OLA in bonding on the sustainability report. And in that report, it said that there was no outcomes. There was no outcomes that were measured, and there was no enforcement of those if it wasn't met, because the benchmarks were like very unclear. So I'm just wondering, knowing what we know from the OLA as well, this bill and the previous bill, I guess, how are we going to know that the outcomes that you have in this bill are truly going to be met when the OLA has said that the current B3 standards are not being met?
Well, I think that's our job as the committee is, like, as I've mentioned many times, is trying to figure out where we can put these kinds of programs in a sustainability resiliency office. Kind of the whole point with the Michigan Infrastructure Council is to really kind of look at that. And I think, you know, what we're doing is making sure I still think about that stupid griddle that I bought at Walmart and how it just didn't last. My $9 griddle that you go and get on Black Friday, and then it falls apart within a few weeks and burns your bacon in some spots and doesn't cook. Well, you're luckier than I am. But I think that's the thing, is that we're really looking at life cycles of our infrastructure. And my main goal is to make sure that these things are what we're investing our taxpayer dollars in is going to last, and it's not making any problems that we're looking future forward to make sure that what we're building is going to be able to handle our changing climate. And that's the thing. And that's what the goal of this committee is, and that's what I'm trying to do. And you know, we're not ignoring climate change. We're adapting to it, and we're making sure it's not getting any worse. So, Representative Ryer, would you like to respond to that, please? So, if you have to answer any questions from Representative Franson, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. There are a couple questions there, one of which I can take and one of which I would like to defer to Professor Graves. The one that I would like to comment on is this bill in the context of the overall OLA report. We are statutorily aligned with meeting the requirements of law in doing this piece. And I think that's important. It's spelled right out in subdivision 4 that we shall review the guidelines periodically and revise to incorporate other standards. So to me, that's what this bill is about. This is quite a narrow bill. However, in the context of the overall OLA report, this is a place where problems were not found, and I think that we should continue with that. The OLA report as a whole, I think, was very constructive in terms of identifying process issues. Process issues, as project managers and researchers have experienced, can lead to a failure to be able to document outcome, whether or not they're happening. And I would argue that to the extent that there aren't clear outcomes, part of it is the lack of clarity in accountability at the state level and how to do that more effectively, which is something I'll be working on. And I would like to then defer to Professor Graves about the costs piece.
Mr. Graves.
Madam Chair, Representative. In terms of answering the cost piece, in the current sustainability guidelines, much of the energy portion increased costs for more insulation or really any energy efficiency measures, we've established a rule that that's actually based in the statute that we have to use a utility method for cost effectiveness. That translates into measures have to have a 12-year payback. So we work with project teams when they're doing, you know, and that payback, depending upon the size of the project, the scale of the project, you really have to review it item by item, project by project, because those paybacks will vary based upon scale. So that drives on the sustainability side, what are the increased costs, and then are those paid for by savings from energy efficiency? As I note in my slide 12 in the presentation, the challenge with the resilience items that you want, that you may want to do, often those things aren't paid for by a simple payback of efficiency, payback in energy efficiency. The return might come in lower insurance costs to the state, better bond rating for the state because of increasing the quality of state construction. And so it's a more indirect payback and therefore more complicated to figure out. So short answer is yes, it could create some additional costs, and we, working with state agencies, we'd need to develop a method to make decisions on, you know, what's the right amount of cost to have a good return for the state for capital construction.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, too, for Professor. I'm just trying to understand what we mean by the resilience to climate change. You know, we talk about 100-year events and 500-year events, and sometimes they're so expensive, we pass on them and don't do them. But could we build a building that could withstand an F4, F5 tornado? I mean, is that possible regardless of cost?
Mr. Graves, Professor Graves.
I don't know the answer to that. And the one thing I will say is that we, when we did our resilience study, we didn't just look at climate change. We looked at any types of disruptions because it's there's too many disruptive weather events and other things. So we looked at whatever those events, whatever the cause, they would disconnect buildings from the electric grid for a period of time, water and wastewater for a period of time, and maybe vehicle transport. And we use that as a proxy for dealing with disruptions. So it wouldn't just be, it could be any event that does a type of disruption, not just climate change. But to answer your question about F4, F5 tornadoes, there are certain events that, as far as I know, it's not possible and wouldn't be cost effective to make them withstand any type of event.
Quick follow-up, then we'll move to Representative Igo and vote on the bill.
Representative Ryer, in your opening comments, and I think I got this right, you said we are now warmer and wetter than ever. Now, ever is a long time. do we have any data that shows that this period now is the wettest we've ever had in the history of whatever?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for pointing out my lack of precision there. I will say in information that I have seen as recorded by Weather Service, and I think that, again, Professor Graves has that up on his screen and can give you numbers.
Representative, or Mr. Graves?
Madam Chair, Representative, in a previous meeting, we shared a slide that showed data from the National Weather Service that between 1958 and 2012, there was a 37% increase in that set of weather data of rainfall events.
Thank you. Representative Igo. No? Okay. Then we'll, Representative Schultz, and then we are going to move to vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ryer. I'm concerned about this bill as it relates to the goals and the purpose of our committee. For the purposes of seeing the long-term advance of oftentimes renewable energy sources that are currently available to us, because we know the data says today that both solar panels and wind turbines have a life cycle ranging most traditionally between 20 and 40 years. And this is particularly related to the sustainability guidelines. And if we're talking about sustainable and the long-term costs to the state, we need to look at that through the lens of the long-term period of time. Our state's been in existence since 1858, and 20 to 40 years, I don't know that that the guidelines provided in this bill help us reach that sustainability, that long-term goal for our state, and I'm concerned about that in this bill.
Any response to that, Representative Rare?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about the long-term sustainability of the state, too, and I appreciate your comment. I would actually just like to have a follow-up conversation at some point about what long-term looks like and get your feedback on that. So thank you.
All right. So I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 749 to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Last on the agenda is Representative Berg with 2170. I will move to re-refer House File 2170 to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Berg, I understand you have an author's amendment, so I will move the A23-0039 for adoption to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. Did you want to explain the amendment at all, or?
No. Madam Chair, no. I think it's self-explanatory.
Okay. Oh, I just didn't look at it, so sorry. All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Berg, please present your bill as amended. We're going to give each of the testifiers about 2 minutes per person because we have quite a few on here. And so I will remind folks when the time is up. So, Representative Berg, go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. I'm really excited to present this bill and the possibilities of its long-term vision and Minnesota's opportunity to be one of the leaders in this space. Buy Clean is a pretty simple concept. It says the products and materials that are used for public projects like infrastructure improvement should be the cleanest and most sustainable available. When we build a bridge or invest in a public building, Buy Clean will help ensure that taxpayer dollars.
Can you just back away from
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
So, we are at spending taxpayer dollars responsibly on materials, including concrete, structural steel, and asphalt that are manufactured in a cleaner, more efficient, and environmentally friendly manner. This reduces climate pollution and negative health impacts while supporting good-paying jobs in Minnesota and in our nation. This bill begins a process to reduce the embedded carbon and environmental footprint in our construction materials in a phased, incremental manner. First, we create a task force led by the Department of Administration that includes stakeholders representing materials manufacturers, the construction industry, labor, environmental organizations, and state agencies. The task force will examine various construction materials, work with product manufacturers, begin to collect data, and start the process of creating environmental product declarations, referred to as EBDs, for a variety of specific construction materials. Eventually, we will have a pilot project, and then down the line, we'll set maximum numeric values on a product-by-product basis that will be included in bid specifications included in state construction products. The task force and stakeholders throughout the industry will play a critical role in shaping how this rolls out. As you will hear, the industry is already moving in this direction. Manufacturers are beginning to create environmental product declarations already. The goal of this bill is to create a process to move this work forward in a coordinated way with all stakeholders involved. One other point that is important to make, America makes cleaner products than those that come from our foreign competitors. This bill is intended to make sure that we're supporting Minnesota industries, especially companies in the cement, steel, and asphalt manufacturing. I will now yield my time to my testifiers.
On our list, we have John Abergast, Margaret Levin, and Mr. Mark Blitzner, if you guys would like to first up, state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
John Arbogast. I'm a District 11 staff rep with United Steelworkers. I am out of the Eveleth office in northern Minnesota. What my functions are, as I represent the steelworkers in 5 out of the 6 mines in northern Minnesota. You're asking me to be brief. I interned legislatively under Tommy Rukavina and David Tomasoni, so this is a huge ask. But anyway, I'm here to testify in support of this bill. The steel companies that our members work for in northern Minnesota have committed towards reducing their carbon footprint. We support them with that. As these projects move forward, the infrastructure bill, moving towards a greener economy, we believe that the steel, the raw materials being used in these government projects should be made in America. They should not come from foreign countries that have no environmental standards and use child labor. So if we're going to spend government dollars, they should be used in this country and in Minnesota. That's as brief as I can get.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Next up, Margaret Levin. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Margaret Levin. I'm the state director for the Sierra Club North Star chapter. The Sierra Club is the nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization. We represent over 50,000 members and supporters here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to express our support for the Buy Clean and Buy Fair Minnesota Act. State level action is crucial to reduce carbon emissions and avoid the worst effects of climate change. Along the way, we need to build a strong clean energy economy, improve our community's health, and ensure good family supporting jobs. Buildings are a major major source of climate pollution, and the issue of emissions that are embodied throughout the life cycle of building materials has emerged as a really important concern, with their manufacture accounting for 11% of total carbon emissions globally. This bill takes an important step towards addressing that problem. The proposed pilot will explore a Minnesota-specific approach to reducing climate emissions in these materials that we need to update our buildings and infrastructure. And the bill will help to support manufacturers who are using cleaner and greener processes and technologies and encourage more manufacturers to do so. We hope it will lead to using our state's considerable purchasing power to buy clean, using taxpayer dollars to reduce climate change and support a strong Minnesota workforce. So we're pleased to join labor, business, and environmental organizations in supporting the bill and urge your support.
Thank you very much. Next up is Mr. Mark Bintzler. Man, I am so bad at this. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record correctly and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Bintzler. I'm with Holcim Incorporated. Holcim is one of the largest cement and construction materials companies in the world. We are in 70 different countries throughout the world and have 70,000 employees. Locally, however, we supply cement, Portland cement, out of a terminal in South St. Paul, Minnesota. We have ready-mix concrete and aggregates out of an office in Eagan, Minnesota, and we have the similar products up in an office in Moorhead, Minnesota. Holcim, as some of you may know, was one of the first major construction company or construction material supplier company that took the net zero pledge. We're working very hard to reduce our carbon footprint. We're by 2050, we're hoping to be net zero. We have intermediate targets. We supply what we call EcoPlanet cements, which has a lower carbon, lower CO2 cement. And we also have EcoPack concrete mixtures that are available for use in construction. We support the bill. Some of the points we support are the advisory committee. Having the industry involved in the process, I think, is very important to make it work in the long term. We also are in support of the Type 3 environmental product declarations. Holcim has all our cement plants in the U.S. have an EPD available, and in Minnesota we can generate an EPD for any of our concrete mixtures as of today. We also are in support of the grant program that's part of this bill, so that other companies that can also develop EPDs, so industry can go forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have public testimony from Mr. Sexton, if you'd like to come down, followed by John Cunningham. will be on deck. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sexton. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Tim Sexton, and I serve as an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Firstly, I want to say that MnDOT supports the goals of this legislation, and we are already working to reduce the impacts of construction projects on the environment and do our part to reduce the climate impacts of transportation. We've met with proponents of the bill, and they have included some of the department's feedback into the legislation. We sincerely appreciate that. Saying that, we do have maybe three examples of process questions that are still out there around modifications to the bid process. One, the source of materials at the time of bid may not be the same as the available source of materials at the time of construction. For example, flooding in North Dakota halted the transport of Coal Creek fly ash to a recent paving project. Changes to the mix design that potentially increased the greenhouse gas emissions of the concrete were made to keep the project on schedule. Additionally, most MnDOT contracts are awarded on a low bid basis. For design build projects, we could award higher scores to proposals whose products have a global warming potential below the maximum acceptable level. However, it's unclear how this requirement would be implemented for low bid contracts. Finally, we'd encourage flexibility in the beginning around timing and project size. In the future, we believe this will become standard operating procedure for all MnDOT projects. But starting with larger projects could be helpful for supporting learning on how this would be implemented. For example, there may be an opportunity to use prices and incentives to support a shift towards lower greenhouse gas materials, and these may be based applied to as place products rather than during procurement, and prices and material material availability may change between when the project is bid and when construction occurs. And actually, finally, MnDOT suggests having the task force submit an interim report to the legislature by February 1st, 2024, that includes recommendations for process, timing, global warming potential for individual projects in case we run into any significant issues as we're implementing this legislation. Madam Chair, again, we support the goals of this legislation. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Berg and other stakeholders as the legislation moves forward.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Mr. Cunningham, followed by Mr. Zeller, and then Brian McDaniel. You are on deck, too. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Cunningham with the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota, also known as ARM of Minnesota. ARM represents the producers of the majority of the materials that this bill would cover. That includes rock, sand, stone, and ready-mixed concrete. I've submitted written comments. You have those in your packet. I'm just going to touch on a couple of highlights within that. In the summer of 2018, we proposed a study with MnDOT to develop a process for inclusion of EPDs in the bidding process. So we are very supportive of the goals of this proposed bill and have been working on that since 2018. And formally since beginning this study with MnDOT. There are some things that Tim just mentioned too that I think we can come up with answers for. We've already had some discussions about that. We would encourage you to allow us to continue to work through that process with MnDOT and give you a process that will lead the nation. We don't think that anybody yet has found a good way to include those EPDs in the bidding process because it is a low bid scenario. We think the key lies in the incentives that Tim mentioned because that does take into account then the end product rather than the intended product at the time of bidding. So we'd like to be able to continue to work through that and would encourage you to do that. And I thank Representative Berg for scheduling a meeting with us next week to talk in more detail about all of these suggestions that we submitted to you in my written testimony. And one other thing that I would encourage you, Madam Chair, and for the committee to consider is that there seems to be one product that is missing from this bill, and that's wood or timber. And that construction, I think, that construction material, I think, needs to be included because of some of the comments that we had in the earlier testimony regarding resilience. Those products, wood and timber products, are used in construction and more so in multi-story construction. And that is concerning if we're not going to keep an eye on resilience. And that also goes towards the use of EPDs and the life cycle assessment that you mentioned also, Madam Chair, about those materials. So I thank you for the time today to address the committee. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Mr. Matt Zeller. You can come down, state your name for the record. There's. And then after Mr. McDaniels will be Laura Ziegler. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and briefly give us your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Matt Zeller. I'm the executive director of the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota. We represent the vast majority of the folks who do all the concrete paving around the state. Again, I really want to applaud the efforts of this bill and, you know, in general, support the spirit of where it's going. Almost all of the industries, as you've heard and will continue to hear, support this. We know we need to do better. We all need to do better. The efforts being taken around the state, around the country, they're already underway. So again, this is it's a good thing, and EPDs is a good start. But again, EPDs is more of a shot in time. It's about what energy is used to create that product. You've mentioned several times, and it's even in the legislation, life cycle. They're different. They're a little different. So I think if we really want to look at the long-term benefits, and Mr. Cunningham mentioned timber. I mean, if you look at a building, it could be built out of timber, it could be built out of steel, it could be built out of concrete. They're all going to have different EPDs to build that. But over the life of that building, how are things going to be affected? The energy use for heating, for cooling. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, life cycle is a great process to get into it. EPDs is a good start. So, I think, you know, we need to continue on this to, you know, to get better. So, again, we believe this legislation, you know, should focus on those last couple of paragraphs, 8 and 9, for the task force and the report. Because, again, everybody's already underway. I know MnDOT's already got, I think, a couple of different federal grants, $200,000 and $300,000 to get into the EPDs. But then what? What should we do with that? And I think that's what that task force would be for, to make some recommendations of how to move forward. Let's use the experts that we have. I know nationally, the asphalt industry, NAPA, has people working on this. NRMCA, the National Ready Mix Association, our national group, ACPA, even MIT has some really good information. So with that, thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Mr. McDaniels, and then Ms. Ziegler, and then we will move on to member discussions. And we do have a real hard stop at 10 because of session. So thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian McDaniel, and I'm here today representing Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. MAPA is a trade association that represents asphalt pavers and producers in the state who pave things from driveways to interstates. For several years now, our industry has discussed the arrival of environmental product declarations and the move towards a green procurement. As you might imagine, different companies are in varying stages of readiness for these changes. On the whole, the asphalt industry has evolved over the years to reduce its environmental footprint. We have done this by being the number one most recycled material in the nation, leading as the smoothest pavement option, resulting in better fuel efficiency for Minnesotans, improving production efficiencies at our plants by incorporating new technologies, and by leading the nation with long-lasting perpetual pavement roadways. Although we have a few questions on the details of the bill, we appreciate the approach taken with a staggered and delayed implementation, a pilot program, and a collaborative process that includes input from all stakeholders. If we're going to go down this road, pun absolutely intended, a process that is based on informed decision-making and reliance on good science and engineering is what should be followed. The science is not clear on how best to achieve these goals, but the asphalt industry and MAPA appreciate the opportunities this bill and Representative Berg are providing to be part of the discussion on how to get there. We'd like to thank the Blue-Green Alliance for being open to changes to allow for greater industry participation, and we will continue to work with them on this bill as it moves through the process. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ziegler. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler with Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're a statewide trade association representing both commercial builders as well as transportation contractors. We understand the overall goal of this legislation to use products and materials that are used for public projects like infrastructure improvements are the cleanest and most sustainable available. I think a lot of the previous testifiers touched on my points. So to get to a couple maybe that you haven't heard, we're going to defer to a number of our partner associations on the sourcing and availability issues. The bulk of our questions are going to reside around that procurement process, and I think we're going to talk about that perhaps at the bill's next stop in committee. So I would also ask the legislature and our public partners to consider the impacts of the total development costs. For example, materials that are thought of as cleaner may have supply chain or availability concerns that would result in longer shipping distances and associated emissions. We also want to consider the impact on small and emerging businesses and recognize that these firms may have similar concerns as to their assets, equipment, and ability to participate in a changing market. So all programs should ensure that women, minority-owned, and or small businesses have the ability to compete for work on these infrastructure projects. We are very supportive of the creation of a task force to engage with industry partners and owner groups to better understand how this bill, other government policies, supply chain realities, et cetera, will impact projects, costs, equipment, materials. And we'll continue the conversation with the representatives to achieve the overall goals of this bill. Thank you for your time. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. We will move to member questions. Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a big thank you to Representative Berg and Blue Green Alliance, Steelworkers, Sierra Club. I first got involved in this about 6-7 years ago. I was leafing through the Steelworkers newsletter and learned about a similar effort in California. And I couldn't believe that you had the trades and the Steelworkers and Sierra Club. I think even 350.org was involved there. And this is a fascinating and really critical and timely bill. And I think just the coalitions that have come together around this, I think show the future of how we can come together on this set of issues. And so I want to thank you and thank all of the people that testified and look forward to seeing this bill come to fruition this year. And really honored to co-author it with you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author as well on this bill. It's exciting to see and to hear from the testifiers today over the way that Minnesota is leading in this regard and the opportunity that we have to expand economic prosperity in our state with the industries that already exist here in Minnesota and how our legislation can benefit that. This bill, I know it's a lot. It's a lot of new language. It's a new process and several steps to the process. And I would just encourage, we're at March 1st right now. We do have committee deadlines coming up, and I fully recognize that. But we want to do best by our industries, our workers, and help us get to a place where we're really putting Minnesota and set up very well. And I just encourage, I know that our side of the aisle has a lot of questions in this regard. We're under a little bit of time constraints, and I would just encourage the chair, if we could, to take this up again after committee deadlines where it can have more full discussion amongst members of the committee. And I believe that the author of the bill is working with the coalition, with the stakeholders, and continued work on that, I think, will continue to enhance this bill. And I just wanted to share that with the amount of time that we have remaining.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we can kind of look at taking deep dives into this after deadline. Representative Anderson.
Thanks. I'll be quick, Madam Chair. Thank you. Yeah, in the discussion with the cement folks, my immediate question was the future of fly ash being used in cement, and if there could be worked into the bill some kind of a, you know, credit system where if you had to use fly ash, you'd have to offset that or buy a credit or something. But is that something you're looking at, and what's the future of fly ash with this bill?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So we are in continued conversations with nearly everyone that has come together on this bill, very open to suggestions and amendments, and we'll be doing so in further stops. But if you'd like our testifier to answer that? I'm sure we could.
Would we be able to answer that one offline, Representative Anderson? Okay, thank you. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will also be brief because a lot of the testifiers hit on everything. Thank you, Representative Berg, for working on this bill. This is a bill that's going to make Minnesota Iron Range steel way more effective here in being used. We're going to stop using that Chinese steel because, Mr. Arbogast, it is not good, right? Thank you. So this is good. The one thing that I wish, you know, if we're going to start looking into this stuff, there's plenty of other things we need to look into on this list. So we're starting with our steel and our concrete, but I think there's plenty of other things we need to be looking into as well. I look forward to having those conversations with you and look forward to see how this bill progresses.
Awesome. Thank you very much. All right. So, members, I will renew my motion that House File 2170, man, thank goodness.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know, like, the path that this bill has to take and how many committees it needs to go to?
Yep. So it's going to State Gov and then Climate and then Ways. So there'll be opportunities to hear it in other committees as well. So
can we get a commitment from you that we can see this after the committee deadlines?
I can't guarantee it just because availability of rooms and things like that. But I think, you know, it's definitely one that we are going to look into. I think this is really prime for, like, infrastructure coordinator, IIJ. I mean, with all of the stuff coming down the pike with that, you know, we're going to see where we're going to need to be on these procurements and stuff. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you do have interest personally.
Absolutely. So, all right.
Madam Chair, quickly.
Representative Berg.
President Biden at the federal level with stated goal of spurring the development of low carbon construction materials made in America while supporting good paying jobs. So there is a federal executive order on BiClean standards.
Thank you. All right, with that, I will re-renew my motion, or I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 2170 as amended to State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. That concludes our agenda for the day. Look at that, even 30 seconds early. So our next hearing will be March 8th at 8:30. Here. Yes, it's so much nicer being in this room. And then we do have an additional meetings reserved for March 10th if we do need it. So members and staff, you should have already received that whole time. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.